I said the evidence that Dr. Schroeder is such a brilliant scientist is the challenge he had in finding our location, so. The hour is late, and it's an incredible testament to Dr. Schroeder's reputation and to all of your desire to learn and to prepare your minds and hearts, not only your kitchens and suitcases, for Pesach, that there's such an incredibly large crowd here on a Monday night, literally the week before Pesach. So I will try to keep the introduction short, and just to remind you what you know, Dr. Schroeder is an incredibly brilliant scientist, a graduate of MIT. He's written many books that reconcile science and Torah, which are an incredible gift to our generation. I can say personally a gift to help resolve such challenging questions and allow us to be able to interact with the world of science without having to forfeit or compromise Torah, to be able to relate to Torah without having to neglect or reject science. It's really a great gift. He's written Genesis and the Big Bang, which has now been translated into 7 languages. He also is the author of The Science of God and The Hidden Face of God, which continue in similar themes. I'll close the introduction by telling you this. Dr. Schroeder's brilliance is only surpassed by his humility and modesty. We had him for a Shabbos many, many years ago as a scholar in residence. At the time, I think I only had 2 children. We were living in Captiva. I was assistant rabbi. And on Saturday night, we had some event we had to go to for the shul. And we insisted on hiring a babysitter, but Dr. Schroeder said, no, he's in the house. It would be ridiculous to get a babysitter. So the kids were put to sleep, and Dr. Schroeder was there. We came back late that night, and I found a note that said, your parents called. So I called my parents back, and I said, you called? Yeah. Who took the message? The babysitter. I said, you know, that was the smartest babysitter in the history of mankind. That is a true story, really reflecting Dr. Schroeder's, not only his brilliance and his wisdom, but his humility and his modesty. So it's a great honor and privilege to have you this evening. Without any further ado, my pleasure to introduce Dr. Gerald Schroeder.
Well, aside from the fact that in the introduction, I've twice heard that anything I said was incredible, which means not credible. I hope we can get beyond that and get to the credible part of the text. So the Nobel laureate Werner Heisenberg, in his Nobel laureate address in 1932, wrote that the first swallow from the cup of the natural sciences produces atheists, but at the bottom of the cup, God is waiting. It's a great statement, because God's in the details, you know. Then the problem is getting to the details. You know, things seem so simple on the surface. You get into your car, just turn on the key, and it's, you know, the way you drive. Until something goes wrong, who knows, a storm or a tsunami, something, you pick up the hood and you can't believe all the complications that go on there, and then 5 hours later the tow truck comes and fixes it for you. So on the surface, life is extraordinarily simple, but in the details, it be the subtlety that underlies this simplicity is revealed. So the difficulty is getting to the bottom of the cup. Of course, the most basic question that exists is, why is there existence? But most of us don't deal with that, because by the time you get old enough to think about existence, you've been existing so long that it's not even interesting. It's a question that nobody bothers to ask because you've been around. Marshall McLuhan said it absolutely perfectly. He said, I'm not sure who discovered water, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't the fish. Now, why wouldn't the fish discover water? Because they're in it all the time. Just like we don't question consciousness and we don't question the very fact of existence. But that's the reality. The things that we take for granted are really the miracles of life. And with that, I'd like to see whether we can't, in fact, determine whether or not we have any markers in this world that there is, in fact, a creator of the world. So I didn't see the title as I walked, as I ran too quickly in, but if it is indeed something like science has discovered God, is that what it is? Is that what we're talking about this evening? Yes? Yeah, okay. And it is true, even atheists exist. In fact, scientists, I didn't realize we'd have this large turnout, so I only have people in the upper
coming to see him. He can't work up here. But the...
Beg your pardon? Oh, Mike. Oh, okay. I'll try to yell a bit louder. The question is, of course, is what is the essence of creation and what brings existence into existence? The last few weeks, there's been this great information about the discovery of information that seems to imply data that support the understanding that there was an initial phase of what's called inflation, a sudden explosion of the universe following the Big Bang creation of the universe. So the Big Bang creation of the universe brings the universe into being, and then there's this sudden one-time phenomena called inflation, which expands the universe from a size that would be vastly smaller than an atom, A-T-O-M, atom, probably certainly subatomic in size, and it expands it by about a factor of 10 to the 25th. That's a one with 25 zeros after. To give an example of what a 10 to the 25th expansion would be, is that if the universe, instead of having started as a quantum event and a subatomic particle, it had come into being as something like, this, like the size of a garden pea, and then you expanded that garden pea by 10 to the 25th, because that's the expansion that takes place, but at a certainly much smaller level, you end up with a amount of pea soup that from one side to the other would take light 100,000 years at the speed of light to travel. That's a lot of pea soup. From one side to the other. It'd be the size of approximately the size of the Milky Way galaxy. But we're starting off, of course, with a creation that's vastly smaller. And the 10 to the 25th expansion gets you somewhere. It's not exactly known because we don't know the exact size of the first bit of creation, but it'd be somewhere between the size of a marble and the size of, let's say, a really large grapefruit or a basketball or something along that, a Florida grapefruit. That would be so, and then that's the end of the inflation, and then the universe moves out from there. What's interesting, though, in looking at, and I bring this down to Genesis and the Big Bang, inflation can only happen once, and it happens immediately after the creation of the universe. Now, I never like to take exactly a sentence from the Bible and say that's what science is talking about. But it is intriguing that the first sentence of the Bible tells us there was the creation of the heavens and the earth. The next sentence tells us the earth wasn't yet formed. So clearly Genesis chapter 1 verse 1 is like a chapter heading, and then the next sentence gets it going, and what we see is a phrase that appears nowhere else in the entire Hebrew Bible. Ruach Elohim Merechefet. The Spirit of God hovering back. Merechefet only appears twice in the Tanakh also, this and again in Deuteronomy. But the phrase, the Ruach Elohim Merechefet, the Spirit of God hovering, is a one-time phenomenon. And it's intriguing that physics also has a one-time phenomenon immediately following the creation. It's called inflation. That's what the news has been in the scientific community just bubbling over tremendously for the last 2 weeks. That beside and the 777 airplane that disappeared with the two new scientific questions. Why you can get out of all radar contact is one question. The other is how do you get the inflation of the universe to get going so you can get people out of a burst of energy. But that's the understanding that this one-time phenomenon called inflation is, if you were looking for a mapping on it from the biblical text, it would be the second sentence of the Bible, where the Spirit of God hovers, a one-time phenomena, and the next sentence is we have light. And that's exactly the sequence. The universe expands out, and in that expansion cools to the point where, in fact, light can escape. Sometimes persons ask other people also, I presume, ask, why doesn't the Bible, if that's really all the stuff that it's talking about, why doesn't the Bible actually tell us this? Why doesn't the Bible come and tell us exactly all these amazing things that happened, instead of just summarizing it? Well, a colleague of mine, blessed memory, Arnie Novak, unfortunately died of cancer two years ago, wrote up a summary of what Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 through 5 would sound like if God were going to give us all this information. So it starts off pretty much the way the Bible starts off. God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was astonishing. It was empty, and it was a turmoil on the darkness of the surface of the deep, and the divine presence hovered over the surface. It's going on like that. God said, let there be light. So far, so good, not much of a problem. But unfortunately, the light was, of course, held in a high-energy plasma that burst forth from nothingness. In fact, a quantum event. But God saw the light was good, but as everyone knows, when coherent light cannot escape from a high-energy plasma, it's held. That's why we can't see into the beyond the surface of the sun, into the sun. So the light was trapped inside the darkness of the plasma field, and God was able to separate, luckily, the light from the darkness by having the plasma cool, and as the plasma cooled, electrons started to bond around protons, and we had the first of the elements, and light could now escape from the high-energy bundle. Okay. As the plasma cooled further, matter and antimatter can condense. It's a phenomenon that Einstein predicted and has been actually done by Stanford University. Was the first. I don't mind that coming from MIT. The plasma cooled further, but the difficulty is, of course, as everyone knows, it's like key to Allah, first grade, that when matter forms from energy, antimatter has to form also in exactly the same amounts. Now, when matter touches antimatter, it's not good for the matter or the antimatter because they both they self-annihilate and go back to the energy. So suddenly we're back to a pure energy. But luckily, by just the nuance of this universe that seems so amazing, there was a bit more matter than antimatter. So we're stuck with matter, which makes us up. And out of that, it just was enough to make the 92 elements that fill the universe today. And then we have evening. God called the evening night. And there was evening and morning. But the problem was it was one cosmic day. But since there was no sun or moon yet, we didn't have any clocks. The cosmic day was, of course, determined by the counting of the oscillation. The background radiation was requested at the quantum event. And God told the people this story, and they responded, what are you talking about? The point of the above story is that God couldn't have explained the creation at the time, in terms of physics at the time of the giving of the Torah, because the people didn't have the vocabulary, nor we barely have it today. On the other hand, God could simply have said, well, okay, we made the heavens and earth in 6 days, and God rested on the seventh. But rather, God revealed the essence of the creation in a hidden manner and left it as a challenge for future generations to unravel the puzzle. We are fortunate to be in the first generation with the tools to understand the golden apple in the silver dish. The golden apple in the silver dish is based on a Proverb 25, verse 11. A word well spoken is like an apple of gold in a dish of silver. And Maimonides pretty much bases his entire Guide for the Perplexed, the 1190. Traditionally, we say that that King Solomon wrote the Proverbs. And Maimonides, in quoting that verse, a word well spoken is like apples of gold in a dish of silver, relates it to the understanding of the Torah. He says, when you look at a dish from a distance, all you see is the beautiful silver dish. You can see its craftsmanship, but you can't see what's inside it. Only when you bring the dish close in do you find the apples of gold. What's the silver dish? The literal text of the Torah, the frontal teaching. Do this, don't do that. Work this way, that don't work that way. And the golden apples? The information held within the text that you can only see by deeply studying each of the words and each of the letters. And Maimonides points out something extraordinary that King Solomon wrote. He wrote apples of gold in a dish of silver, and not apples of silver in a dish of gold. And he writes gold is more beautiful and more valuable than the silver. They're both valuable, but the two together explode the text way beyond the simplistic reading. The apples of gold are essentially how God runs the world. The silver dish is how we run our world. I mean, you could call the apples of gold Kabbalah, but people have a bad, you know, sometimes think it's flaky. Kabbalah isn't mysticism. Kabbalah is how God runs the world, which can give you a mystical experience when you get beyond some of the subtleties of the text. I mean, a classic example of an apple of gold in a dish of silver. Most of you probably know Genesis chapter 1. To some extent, it's broken into 6 days. And at the end of each day, the same phrase repeats itself. Anybody know the phrase? Huh? There was evening and morning. One day, or if he had revoke, one day, next, if he had revoke, Yom Shin, evening, morning, a second day, more things happen, if he had morning, a third day, evening, morning, a third day, and then you might say on the fourth day, the shoe hits the floor, I think it's an expression like that, Anyone recall what happens on the fourth day of the 6 days of Genesis? I mean, it's easy for me because I got it right in front of me. But what? The sun and the moon. That's a kind of an interesting thing. The sun and the moon. Now, that's kind of interesting because I always thought that, like, evening was the result of sunset and morning was the result of sunrise. We've got a problem here. I mean, how do you have evening and morning for those days when there's no sun? Even though the Talmud already says the sun might have been present, the Rashi says the sun might have been present earlier, certainly wasn't there in the very first day. So this is all Nachmanides, the 11-eyed, the Mikubal. When it's Schroeder, I let you know. Nachmanides says the following: there must be an apple of gold in the silver dish, because it can't mean the silver dish reading Erev. The silver dish reading of Erev is evening, and in modern Hebrew today, Erev Tov, good evening. But there's a deeper meaning to Erev. He said the root meaning of Erev, Ayin Resh Beit, is an evening. The root meaning of Erev is mixture, chaos. And as Nachmanides writes, the reason we use Erev for evening is because when the sun sets, vision becomes chaotic, blurry. I found that coming here, and that's why I'm 15 minutes late. Okay, and when the sun rises, it's harder to see, but it's the Ramban, Nachmanides, so I have no problem using it. He says, what's the exact opposite? I said, Boker. Boker, the silver dish reading is morning, because when the sun rises, clarity comes to it, and the root meaning, he writes, is that it's that it's orderly or able to be discerned. Erev we see more clearly because we have an Eruv. And does Bok have an Eruv? So what does an Eruv allow you to do? Why? I can carry it on this room all I want. What does an Eruv allow you to do? Why does an Eruv allow you to carry? Because it mixes all the domains. That's why it's an Eruv. It mixes all the domains together to one big domain. So we have, instead of evening into morning, which you need, that's all you need to know to get home on time. But you're missing the golden apple. The golden apple isn't there as evening as morning. You don't have his sun until the fourth day. The deeper meaning is there was Erev and there was Boker. There was disorder, chaos, and there was order. And the Torah is so astounded by this flow and wants us to be astounded by the flow that six times over, in each level, the higher and higher levels of order, day by day, Erev gave way to Boker. Now that's something that never happens in nature. It's an unequivocal statement that order never, not sometimes, order never arises from a disorderly system spontaneously and remains orderly. There's two sentence parts of the sentence. Order never arises, never, not rarely, never arises from a disorderly system, from chaos, and remains orderly unless something in nature recognizes that order, if it's part of nature already. I teach in Jerusalem, in the Old City, and if I look carefully in a direction, I almost get to see the lowest exposed point on the earth, which is the Dead Sea, which is not really dead, there are brine shrimps there, but there's salt crystals all around. Now, those salt crystals have been built into the universe before there was a universe. Not the Dead Sea necessarily, but if a person could have existed before the universe and was given this book of the laws of nature and the laws of physics and laws of chemistry, you could have predicted many things. One could have predicted the formation of the elements, but you could also predict that if you got hydrogen and oxygen together in a proper order, proper temperature, they would combine and form something we call water. And if you took sodium and bromine and chlorine and mixed them up, ions of these, and put them in the water and let them dissolve, and let the water evaporate, you could have predicted that the shape of the crystals would look like this and never like that. The crystals in the Dead Sea have been built into the universe since before there was a universe, the shape of the crystals. Not necessarily the Dead Sea and not those specific crystals, but the shape of them is part of nature. The reason that we're made of amino acids, nature likes amino acids. We find them through space. Okay, so if the order that arose from this burst of energy, because the Big Bang didn't produce, you know, matzo balls. The Big Bang produced energy. That's all that came out of the Big Bang, energy. And the energy, as the universe expanded, thanks to Arnie Novick, we just got done seeing that, condensed into matter. And the matter condensed and finally became people. Sometimes sleeping through lectures. I try to avoid that, but it's a problem, actually. It's a big problem because, you know, actually, one of the major difficulties in having an evening lecture after dinner Let's face it, staying awake. It's, I mean, it's a real problem, but luckily, and it's pure, I shouldn't say it's lucky, but science has come to the help of the boring lecturer. And that's the good news. Because science has proven with no equivocation, absolutely, that sleep improves the immune system. So if you sleep through this talk, you'll be healthier when you leave than when you came in. Okay. So, anyway, so how has science discovered God so literally that even atheists agree? And I, you know, get to talk to some of these guys from time to time, the big ones like Hawking, etc. And they do accept the fact that there might be a God. It's usually, though, the definition of God that they have problems. But how have we? I'm so sorry, I was not at all prepared for such a... in the back room, you go to sleep. You can be just as well. Okay, anyway... I know you can't see it, but if you have an iPhone and you want to find it, just go to NASA, N-A-S-A, and you can watch this on your phone right now. And when you get to NASA, just type in WMAP, or go to Google Images and type in WMAP, the initials of a satellite. And what, for those of you that can see this, because it's vastly too small for this size of room, but we have a creation, it's a description of the universe expanding over time, from a burst of energy out to us here, in this satellite that map this history. It's a timeline. The universe is expanding in all directions, as this oval shows, but it's expansion over time. But what's crucial here is to try to, for the information that, in fact, the discovery of God, is that the diagram here, and this is the condensed knowledge of the scientific community. It comes right off the NASA site, every word here has, and this piece of paper is at least 5 years old. You can go right now, you find the identical diagram. But what it has here is a force that creates the universe. Now, at least you can see the light and the dark, even in the back row, I presume. This marks the beginning of the universe. And the fact that we have here an arrow or a line showing the creation, well, our understanding of time starts with the universe itself. So to say predates is difficult to say. We're stuck with language, but it looks like science holds by the fact that these two words here, quantum fluctuation, which is an aspect of the laws of nature, that the laws of nature create the universe from absolute nothing. Sometimes there's a fantasy that the very fact that there's a creation of the universe from absolute nothing proves there's a God. It doesn't. It proves the person that's talking to you hasn't studied enough physics. The fact is, you do not need a God to create the universe from absolute nothing. Nature allows yesh ma'ayin. It's hard to accept that after you get this pumped in, you can't. Nature allows creation of something from absolute nothing. The laws of nature. Provided you've got the laws of nature. So what science has told us is that we can create the universe from absolute nothing, provided we have the laws of nature that predate the universe. This was first theory presented. It's all theory because we can't see back this far. Science has been saying that for, you know, a century, and the creation of Torah has been saying it for 3,000 years, that we can't see the creation itself because the first letter of the Bible is a what? Bet, and it's closed in all directions, right? And open only in the third direction. So we have here a force or forces of nature creating the universe from absolute nothing. Well, if the nature creates the universe from absolute nothing and our understanding of time starts with the universe, then that means that the laws of nature predate our understanding of time. That means the laws of nature are outside of time. This is science speaking. Okay, this is not some theological statement, although it is probably the strongest theological statement that science will ever be able to make. So the laws of nature predate the universe. They're outside of time. The laws of nature create the universe from absolute nothing. The laws of nature are not physical, but they interact with the physical. In fact, they created the physical. And the laws of nature are not physical. They interact with the physical. They're outside of time, and they create the universe from absolute nothing. That should start to sound very familiar. Outside of time, not physical, create the universe from absolute nothing. Gosh, what does that sound like? It happens to be 80% of the biblical definition of God. And that's where science says, okay, if you want to call that God, I'll call it God, because it is the biblical definition of God, about 75 or 80% of the definition. Not physical, outside of time, can in fact enter time, because energy goes inside and outside of time, and creates the universe from absolute nothing. The question that remains, though, is that which created the universe, interested in the universe that it created. It's worth reading the description of this
phenomena of creating the universe from nothing. I'm pretty sure I have it in God According to God, but I have it right here in a piece of paper, so I'll just read it from here.
It was first presented, this idea of the laws of nature creating the universe from absolute nothing, by Professor Ed Tryon. And here's how he writes. Here's a summary. In 1973, it's 40 years ago already, but it's still the understanding of the scientific community. In 1973, it occurred to me that relativity and quantum theory might imply the spontaneous creation of universe from absolute nothing. If so, matter and energy would not be fundamental. Matter and energy would be manifestations of underlying laws. Ultimate reality would not be physical. Ultimate reality would be the laws themselves, in essence, the mind of Einstein's God. Physics, the idea that you can't have theology in a science classroom, is outdated, because science has brought the theology in the form of the metaphysical. A metaphysical force created the universe. A force outside the physical created the universe from absolute nothing. That is the only understanding we have of how something, our universe and us, came into being. So the question then comes down to the idea of whether or not this something that comes into being from nothing is God or not. That God might use the laws of nature to create the universe. Well, we can't tell that from Genesis chapter 1, because Genesis chapter 1 is like a zoom lens. The first day is the whole universe. By day 3, it's the earth. By day 6, it's people. You know, it just zooms right in onto the topic. So there's almost no data given in Genesis chapter 1 on how God runs the world. It just says what was done. But the rest of the text tells us a lot of how God runs the world. So if we're asking that the laws of nature could create the universe from nothing, is it conceivable that the God of the Bible would create the laws of nature and then use them to create the universe? In other words, does God ever use nature to get things done? And the answer is astounding, yeah. I mean, a powerful yes. Any examples where God would use the forces of nature to get something done?
No.
What? No, the flood. Yeah, like something more germane to the moment.
Red Sea.
The Red Sea, the Sea of Reeds, the splitting of the sea. The splitting of the sea. That splitting of the sea, that opening of the sea, was so natural that after the Israelites went in, who follows them right on in? It's just the wind. But when the waters are coming back, they say, Ya Habibi, God is fighting the Israelites, and they try to get out. So they probably did tshuva. They couldn't do physical tshuva, but they maybe did spiritual tshuva. So the idea that God might use the laws of nature is totally consistent with how God runs the world. And a nice, a simple, a kind of like a front of our Torah for the Pesach Seder. There's only one place in the entire Tanakh that the Yam Suf, what the Yam Suf is identified. There's only one place in the entire. I remember it as the number 1926, first book of Kings, chapter 9, verse 26 is the only location in the entire, not just the Torah, the Tanakh, where the Yam Suf, which is what the Hebrew calls it, Yam Si Suf reads, is identified. And it says, King Solomon built a fleet of ships by Etzion Gever, which exists till today, next to Eilat, which is where Etzion Gever, on the banks of the Yam Suf. I'm putting the Hebrew in so we realize that. King Solomon built a fleet of ships by Etzion Gever, next to Eilat, on the banks of the Yam Suf. That's all correct. So what would the Yam Suf be? What would it be? What? Yeah, well, that's the beginning of it. Yeah, he would be building the Akabe Eilat. It'd be the Red Sea, yeah. Which is kind of interesting to kind of position where Mount Sinai wouldn't be, as opposed to where Mount Sinai might be. They're going from west to east, to Midian, which makes a lot of sense because that's where Moses found refuge when he had to flee from Pharaoh. So we have to figure out, I'm not going to get to where it might be, but what's on the west side of, what's on the east side of the Sea of Reeds, of the Red Sea? Saudi Arabia. Yeah, Saudi Arabia's on the other side there. A little bit of Jordan, but mostly Saudi Arabia. Anyway, that's just a bit of Torah for Torah. So this idea in 1926, first book of Kings, chapter 9, verse 26 and 27. It's a deep water body. It does, now, that statement doesn't say which part of the Yam Suf they crossed. But could a wind split the sea? Is it even conceivable that a wind, a strong wind, verse 20, Genesis, Exodus chapter 14, verse 21, God makes a strong east wind blow all night. Is it conceivable that a wind could possibly split the sea? Well, two scientists tried to figure out if it could or it couldn't. What they didn't do is bring a big fan down to the Yam Suf. They might have tried it. But what they did do, Nof and Paldor are the names, they did a computer study, they're meteorological persons, and did a computer study trying to determine what it would take to split the sea. No one knows, they don't know either, but where exactly along that Yam Suf it is. They picked a logical place where there might be like a Vadi, which would direct the wind, so it'd be like focused to do whatever it would do. In any event, they discovered that a 40 mile an hour wind, which is not a tornado by a long stretch, you can easily hold your hand out of a car going 40 miles an hour, 8 hours would split the sea. Turning off the computer, the wind in the computer, the water comes back. It was a computer study, and it's a flood. Now that should be absolutely uninteresting to anyone in here, because you're hearing me, a Bible thumper, tell you that. And obviously I'll do it. But what makes it very interesting is they published the results in the world's leading peer-reviewed journal of meteorology. It's a meteorological study. The Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society is as high as you can get in studies of meteorology. Are there oceanographic explanations for the Israelites crossing the Red Sea? And the answer is yes. So what's the miracle? What do they say in real estate? Location, location, location. The location and the timing would be the miracle. The problem is that nature always looks natural, almost by definition. We take all these things for granted. We take things for granted, like just moving your fingers. If we could see the, not millions, but billions of chemical reactions that are taking place just to move your fingers, blink your eye, it wouldn't seem so simple. That's the problem is, it's always at the bottom of the cup that we find the subtlety of God. So what are the data to go beyond the 75% that science has accepted, that if you want to call that God, a force, not physical, outside of time, creates the universe from absolute nothing? So that's most of the biblical definition of God, but it could be a deist God. Sets the world in motion, winds it up, and lets it run. Are there data that imply that there's something more going on than just that phenomenon? So Moses Moses tells us in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 7, that there are two types or categories of markers that tell us that God is active in this world. Moses essentially says, if you want to figure out if God is active in the world, Zechor Yemot Olam Bino Chinot Dor V'Dor. Remember the days of old, or look at this flow of social history from generation to generation. So Zechor Yemot Olam, according to the Ramban, is the Sheshet Mei Breishit, the 6 days of Genesis, that the flow of a burst of energy could condense and become life is extraordinary. We just take it for granted. But the simple fact is, it isn't quite as simple as it might actually be, because once you get below the surface, the complexity is really extraordinary. I'm going to give a simple example, which we take absolutely, how our brain works to understand what's happening. If you look, if you hold your finger, or whatever, and you move the finger like this, and you follow with your eyes, what's happening is the image is falling on a different part of the retina. Or you might actually do it more simply, just look at something like the door or something and move your head. So as the image changes on the retina, the position on the back, you know, where you get the image, well, why don't you think the door is moving? If you see a person walking across in front of you, that image is doing the exact same thing. It's changing the position on the retina. So that you know the person is moving. So why don't you think the door is moving as you move your head? Because as far as your eye is getting the information and your brain is getting the information from your eye, that door is moving, just like a person moves, because that's all the information coming in here. But there's another set of information coming in also in your brain, which you don't even think about. The brain is also registering the fact that your head is moving when you look like this at the door. And then which is going to trump the other? And we discover that the motion of the head trumps the image on the eye, and it says that door's not moving, your head is moving. But as far as the visual information coming in, it is identical. It may not be too interesting, but you get to things like that, and after a while you begin to wonder, something pretty clever is going on here. And that, in fact, is what earned for Nobel laureate George Wald the Nobel Prize. He worked with vision. He starts off his life as an absolute agnostic / atheist. Jewish atheists are really, you know, Gentile atheists, I don't mean to insult any Gentiles, but you're lightweights compared to Jewish atheists, okay? I mean, I don't know why it's that, but that's the way it is. And Barbara and I just spent the whole weekend discussing this type of thing with a group of magnificent human being Gentiles. But, you know, it's a different category. So, anyway, Wald starts off his life, you don't need God, life could start by chance, and then he got to the bottom of the cup. It's exactly what Heisenberg said. You get to the bottom of the cup, and then suddenly you realize it's just too complex. And he earns the Nobel Prize for discovering about vision. Well, I can look over here, and you, sir, should not be insulted, but as soon as I turn my head, I don't see you any longer. And don't take it for granted. I mean, I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but I don't see you. He didn't take it for granted. That as fast as you can turn your head, the image that finally gets somewhere in your brain changes. And that's pretty amazing because the reactions that are going place, they're taking picoseconds. And it's chemistry that's going on. And it wasn't that you just take it for granted. The fact is he earned the Nobel Prize for discovering some of the aspects like vitamin A, etc., that in fact allow this to happen at as fast as you can move it. And having earned that, and again it's at the quantum level, he writes like this in the International Journal of Quantum Chemistry, peer-reviewed. It has occurred to me lately, I must, listen to his statement, it has occurred to me lately, I must confess with some shock at first to my scientific sensibilities, not surprising since he started off his life saying you don't need anything, it's all by chance. It has occurred to me lately, I must confess with some shock at first to my scientific sensibilities, that both the questions of the origin of life from non-living matter and of the origin of consciousness in that life that arose from non-living matter might be brought to some degree of congruence. This is with the assumption that mind, M-I-N-D, mind, rather than emerging as a late outgrowth in the evolution of life, has always existed as the matrix, the source and condition of physical reality. The stuff of which the physical universe is composed is mind stuff. It is mind that has composed the physical universe, that breeds life, and eventually creatures that know and create the sciences and the arts. In them, the universe begins to know itself. The simple fact is, more basic than the physical reality of the world is a metaphysical reality of the world called mind. It's hard to accept that fact, but it's hard to accept the fact that we are literally made of the light of creation. There's one physical creation, according to Torah. There's one, and 3,000 years after Torah, science discovers there's one physical creation. Everything is made from the light of creation. We entered that universe 14 billion years ago as a burst of light. As we measure time, they're going to get into the age of the universe. I have that on my website. It's easy to, you don't have to buy the books. It's all there on the website. And we literally are made of the stuff of creation. As depressing as it might be, when you look in the mirror in the morning, and for some of us it's really bad news, you know, you're literally looking at the light of creation, not poetically, in the light of creation in the form of you. Everything is made from that. May I pick up this bottle? So, I mean, just like this is hydrogen and oxygen. Is this yours?
No, it's yours.
It's mine.
Yes.
What's dripping all over my hands here, it's the last time of... did anyone... here's a half-empty bottle, I see. Someone drank from that bottle, right? When you drank from that bottle, did you say, all right, honey, it can't be hydrogen and oxygen on a hot day. I mean, give me some hydrogen and oxygen. Did you say that? No? Because when you're drinking water, you're literally drinking hydrogen and oxygen in a special form we call water. It never stops being hydrogen and never stops being oxygen. It just takes on the form of water. And that's what we did in the light of creation. We literally took on the form of us and the table. Everything is made from that extraordinary beginning. So in that sense, when we look at these markers that Moses says exist to show whether it's a deus God or whether it's actually God present in the universe. The idea, Zechor Yemot Olam, remember the days of old, the 6 days that take a burst of energy, expand. Einstein tells us energy can condense and form into matter. It's important to remember that. What's the famous equation? E equals mc squared. What that equation does not say is the energy disappears and becomes matter. That's exactly what it does not say. It says energy can condense and take on the form of matter, but it always remains energy. The first of the big long series of atomic bombs I've seen detonated was a uranium-235 bomb. That was in the States. It wasn't that uranium-235 metal, under certain conditions, can then change and become energy. The uranium-235 metal is always energy, but in the form of a metal, like the water is always hydrogen and oxygen, but in the form of water. It's just that it's easier to get energy out of uranium-235 than it is, let's say, to get energy out of rose petals. But a gram of rose petals has the exact same energy within it that a gram of uranium has. I would never, if any of you men are questioning, my suggestion is don't give your wife uranium-235. Stick with rose petals. That kind of energy you really want better. But it's the phenomena of this of life developing from this burst of energy over the 6 days is the physical end. And then the other side, Zechor Yemot Olam, Bino Chinot Dor V'Dor, look at the flow of social history. Does that show any nuance? And there, God tells us, the Torah makes a prediction, and God says point blank, there will be a marker in this world, and the marker is the people of Israel, for better or for worse. We know it can be because there's great Jews, and there are not such great Jews. And Madoff would be an example of a lousy Jew. You know, can the world know he's Jewish? And it's a ultimate chilul Hashem that you can pass desecration of God's name, what he did. But then there's Salk and Sabin and polio being, etc., you know, and software for cell phones, you know, etc. The list goes on and on. Fortunately, the good is usually outweighs the bad. But God does say that Jews will be the marker in the world, and we're here as a marker not just for Jews, but for the rest of the nations as well. When God takes us out of Egypt, and then in our usual stupidity, we build the golden calf. And if you look at the word carefully, it's usually the men that do it, not the women. The trump card that Moses pulls out of the deck, God says, God says, Nachanichali, leave me alone, so I can destroy the people. And then Moses reads to God the facts of life. It is true, you can destroy the people, but it's not a good idea. It's not your best interest, because the Egyptians will say, you just took them out in the desert to kill them. Who cares what the Egyptians say? You know who cares? God. Because we're the marker for the rest of the world, and God's real interested in having this information spread around the world. The exact same thing happens when we send spies into, my wife is Barbara Sofer, great writer, you should look her up, phenomenal, rabbisofer.com. Anyway, she calls it pre-state Israel. We send spies into Canaan, pre-state Israel. They come back, say the world is just great. Canaan is just great. But there's giants there, and the men say go back to Egypt. The women say go forward. The men die in the desert. The women don't die in the desert except Miriam. And God says, this time I'm going to wipe out the whole, I'm going to wipe you. It's just the end. And Moses again reads the facts of life to God. So he said, it's true, you can destroy the people of Israel. But it's not in your best interest. Because the nations of the world will say you're a wimp and aren't strong enough to bring us into Canaan. Notice the trump card every time? It's the nations of the world. We are the marker in this world that there's a God active in this world. We take that deist understanding of God from the quantum fluctuations that create the world and essentially demonstrate in a 3,000-year-old prediction that we will always stand out. Sometimes, rarely, thank God, for the worse, usually for the better, but we'll always stand out. And Christians and Jews and atheists alike hold by the accept this fact. The first talking movie? What was the topic of the first talkie? Movies, for those that don't remember, was in The Jazz Singer about Yom Kippur. I mean, can you imagine? The first movie ever made with voice in it is about Yom Kippur. I mean, after a while, yeah, God's got us like the nose. I'm here. Anyway, so the list goes on. I don't want to just belabor the point, but we have this understanding that there is an active world, God in this world, that God may have used the laws of nature to create the world, but having created the world from absolute nothing, we then have the problem of being partners with God. We have to partner with God to try to pull this all together and make the world a place that might be a bit better for living in than it is at the moment. Because the world is, as a colleague of mine from Turkey says, the world is perfectly imperfect. That is to say, there are imperfections. One example would be, there are examples galore. Sometimes God pulls back this idea of let's attempt to pull back, and it lets these imperfections move forward, hopefully that we'll correct them. And sometimes, like someone said, the flood, God changes the world to try to slap it around to get it back in shape. So that is pretty much what I was trying to mention tonight as I was struggling to get here on time, which I failed. But I'd be happy to take questions. If there are other things that were specifically interesting, yes, in the way in the back. Yes?
Going back to Merafefet, Ruchelakim Merafefet, the wind and power of the Spirit of Hashem, Hovid, the rest of the sentence, Merafefet Alpinei
Hamayim.
How does the word Mayim, if you translate it as water, fit into what you were saying earlier?
I would think that Mayim is probably there because the Chazal don't deal with it, at least what I've studied. Would be the general substance of the universe. I mean, nature likes water. Water is found throughout the universe. At that point, though, there wouldn't be actually there would be if you get further down in time-wise, but at that point with Ruach Elohim Rechefet and breaks this plasma and going out, you're not going to have liquid water because, first of all, the whole universe is only about this size. So I see it as the basic substance. The first of the atoms that form the ions form are hydrogen. And, that's a good fraction of what water is made of. So it's not a good answer, but it's the best answer I have. I don't think in my understanding, it doesn't relate actually to water, but it uses terms that we can understand. That's the basic, that's like the whole thing with Arnie Novak's statement. We're stuck with the level of understanding that we have. The Torah speaks in the language of man. It might be actual water, but at that stage in the universe, it wouldn't have liquid water. Rabbi.
Do you apply your understanding of the splitting of the sea as a natural phenomenon, the miracle only being when and where, to every miracle described by the Torah? Are there any exceptions that you think are really supernatural or metaphysical miracles?
Yeah, well, we see it in with Elijah on Mount Carmel, where fire is brought down from heaven, right, to eat up the Baal priests are saying, we're the good guys, and Elijah is saying, no, God is the good guy. That's so interesting, good force. And finally the fire comes down. the difficulty with miracles. So I would think that would be an explicit example. Here, with the splitting of the sea, it says explicitly that in Exodus 14:21, and God made a strong east wind blow. So we see explicitly that God makes this blow, but it looks obviously looked natural because the Egyptians followed everyone in. Would it be plagued? Well, with the fire coming down, we hear Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem Hu Elokim. Right? So apparently the experience was so extraordinary that the people saw it as a miracle because the Baalniks failed and Elijah calling on God succeeds. Now that was so successful that that Jezebel tells to Elijah, tomorrow you're going to be dead, because the people then killed the Baal priest because they figured it wasn't such a good idea that they'd been murdering their sons and daughters. At least they were, let's how do you say it, sex, what do you say, you know, not gender equal. They killed their daughters as well as their sons. So you give them credit for that at least. They weren't prejudiced. So the Israelites are not too happy, so they kill the Baal priest. So Jezebel says to Elijah, tomorrow at this time, you're going to be dead like my Baal priest. You're going to be dead also. Why tomorrow? Why not today? I mean, Jezebel's got him there. She's got the army. It's the people that, the Baal priest may be gone, but she's got the army. Why would she possibly wait till tomorrow? We know why. Because tomorrow was summer lightning. It wasn't God. Today it looks like God, but by tomorrow it's rationalized. You know, and guess who also understands it? Elijah. Because what does he do? He flees for his life. Because he knows that by tomorrow the people won't be standing by him. And if you want to see a modern, I apologize, I loved it, but if you want to see a modern version of it, just like watch the movie High Noon. Okay, it's exactly the same. Beg your pardon? The other ten. Twice. I have never followed this through, but Discovery Channel twice, according to an associate in Australia who's twice sent me the cold videos of them. It's Discovery Channel twice, about maybe 5 and 10 years ago, ran programs showing how one plague could lead to another. Okay. I think the problem with why it didn't convince Pharaoh, that's for sure. I mean, time, as Barbara points out, time after time, it gets hit on the head right here, 1, 2, 3, and it's even if they look like they're miraculous, it was totally unconvincing because they had to have 10 plagues. Why not after one plague? But it was interesting, Chaim Bravender pointed out something that was interesting. I don't know if it's original with him, but I heard it from him. That the problem of the first plague, where the magicians turn their sticks into serpents, and Moses turns his stick into serpents, and then, you know, Moses' serpent eats up the Egyptian serpents. At that point, that the fact that the Egyptians could make sticks into serpents also, so to Pharaoh, it looked like, okay, so Moses was a better magician than his people. But, you know, the town next, two towns over, there's probably better magicians than Moses. But once you get after that point, it all could be seen as sleight of hand or not magic. Because we see it wasn't convincing. Because it took 10 plagues and that barely worked. It didn't work. Because, you know, shortly thereafter, the Egyptians have said that wasn't a miracle either, and they're chasing after the people. So, were the 10 plagues miraculous? The Discovery Channel twice showed how they could follow one from the other. One was sent by a person that worked in the earth sciences, and the other was a virologist that demonstrated how each plague could follow from the other. I don't think that's the origin of the plagues, but I have a feeling Pharaoh did. Otherwise, why didn't just one plague convince him to give up? And it didn't. So just like with Elijah on the mountain, it's just not convincing. Miracles don't convince.
Yahushua and the son.
Yeah. That would seem to be a miracle. Did the battle take place after that? Yeah, you would think the other army would have fled. But they didn't. There was a battle that took place. You know, at that point, you think everybody would run away. Miracles just don't convince. Maybe that's why God just said, let the universe look natural. I mean, it doesn't, you know, why break my head making things, you know, miracles? They're not going to believe him anyway. Yes. Well, either one. You two decide which one.
How do you fit creation into infinity? What's the correlation between the two?
Well, there's a lovely sign, I quote it in Genesis of the Big Bang, I think, on the Pecan Street Cafe in the men's room wall. Time is God's way of making everything not happen all at once. Okay? But if you're outside of time, everything does happen all at once. And what's amazing is in this world, we have an example of being inside and outside of time. You know, we would say, if God knows, HaKol Tzifui V'Shut Netuna in Perkei Avot, and also elsewhere, I think it's in Sanhedrin, some other place, that everything is foreseen but free will is given. It sounds like an oxymoron. If everything is foreseen by God, how do you have free will? Has tomorrow already happened? And I'm just playing this out like a robot. But the simple fact is that not necessarily the case, because the pristine answer would be, well, God's outside of time, so that tomorrow is now also. If you can accept that, then you don't have any argument in the first place. But what's important is that in this world, usually, I've been told, that when there's an aspect that is crucial for understanding how God acts in this world, there will always be something in the physical world that mirrors that. And being inside and outside of time, understanding that, how that, because then tomorrow isn't, if you're outside of time, like the song says, there's no tomorrow. And if you're outside of time, you can't say tomorrow. So an example of being inside and outside of time. It's a little thing I do with my head to try to understand, you know, to understand this. That energy is the example. At the speed of light, time doesn't exist. But we don't exist in that framework. We exist in a framework in which at the speed of light has a number. But if you're outside of time, there's no number. So just a really quick, it takes about 3 minutes to do this, but it works for me. It's the only work. I wake up in the morning having a discussion. My soul is discussing something with my seichel. My neshama is talking with my brain. Now the neshama is straight in from God, and the brain is trying to convince the neshama, really impress it. So it's talking about all different things, and finally the brain to really, you know, I mean, just knock the socks off the neshama, says, you know what? It takes 8 minutes and 15 seconds for the sunlight to reach the earth. Well, the neshama thinks that's pretty strange, because you know why? Why? Because the neshama knows that the source of the entire food chain is photosynthesis. And you could be a carnivore that wouldn't let, God forbid, a tomato in your house and a lettuce, never. But the cow you eat and grew up on lettuces and tomatoes and, you know, on grass. So the food chain is crucial. Why would God put the source, the energy, the sunlight for the photosynthesis that makes the grass grow 8 minutes away? Ridiculous. God could do it better. So the brain says, that's the way it is. So the neshama steps out of my body, leaving your neshama so I stay human, zips up to the sun, goes up to the sun, and on the sun, the neshama, being just amazing, can look in and notice that there's going to be a transition. An electron is going to jump from one higher level to another and emit a photon. That's what makes light, and I can see the colors in different ways. Well, we have no idea how that happens. You should understand. We just say that. But why should energy dropping from one level to another emit a photon? I mean, was it like invented out of, you know, it happens, we know it happens, there's not a single explanation for it, but we accept it. So that photon's going to come right down into the kitchen and hit me square in the eye. So the neshama zips down and tells me, you start your watch, it's going to happen in 5 minutes, and I'm going to take a neshama watch, go up here to the sun, start my watch, stop watching, 5 minutes. 5 minutes go by, click, click, the neshama starts its neshama watch, doesn't slow the light beam down at all, zooms towards the earth. Meanwhile, back in the kitchen, I start my stopwatch, but I know it takes 8 minutes, so I'm not...
You went beat. You were your neshama.
Yeah. So I decide, let's say it's Sunday morning, so there on the shelf is challah. Well, you can't toast challah on Shabbat, but toasted challah is just great. So it's Sunday morning. I just am about to slice it. I know next to the challah is cinnamon raisin. Nothing beats cinnamon raisin for toast. So I put in the toast and put the challah back. And I'm going to decide, well, I have breakfast. Well, I would like to eat high fiber, fiber one or something. But, you know, it's an experimental day, and the water's boiling. I have poached eggs. Who cares what the clothes are? Put the eggs in, poach. Take the challah. Look in the refrigerator. There's some margarine. Trans fats in the garbage. Take the butter out. Slap it on. Don't eat. And I still have 3 minutes to bench. I bench. Meanwhile, through space, the neshama is speeding. It arrives in the kitchen. It shuts off its neshama stopwatch, and I start off my stopwatch. On my stopwatch, 8 minutes and 15 seconds went by. How much time went by on the neshama stopwatch, which traveled at the speed of light from the sun to the earth?
93.
Zero. Right? not a little, zero. One event from two perspectives. One event from two perspectives. In my perspective, it took 8 minutes because I live inside time. For the neshama traveling at the speed of light, zero time. And they both happen in exactly the same time. Which means that if that photon had, let's say, been in my kitchen, bouncing back and forth between two perfectly reflecting mirrors, never losing the speed of light, it would have seen me decide between challah and cinnamon raisin, between high fiber, fiber one or some, and poached eggs, between butter or margarine, and it would have seen me do all those things in how much time? Zero. We can't understand it. That's why we have an example in the world. God doesn't know the future. God, if you're outside of time, the word future has no meaning. God knows the eternal now. It's simultaneous, and that doesn't fit in our heads because everyone in this room and everyone on earth thinks in the same box, a box confined by time and space and matter and you can or energy, and you cannot abstract them from your thoughts. We're stuck in that box. So we have an example in this world that lets us know very clearly that although God knows, the biblical God knows past, present, and future as a simultaneous now, tomorrow hasn't happened inside of time for anyone, including God. But you're outside of time. You know, the word tomorrow is about as meaningless as woogly, ugly, and diggly, and zoogly, a meaningless sound. Because if you're outside of time, there's no tomorrow, and there's no yesterday, and there's the dinosaurs, the whole kit and caboodle. But we can't, it doesn't fit in here. So we have this example. Which unfortunately means, I can wrap it up, but this unfortunately means that we are responsible for how we act tomorrow. Because by tomorrow we'll know what God knows right now as the eternal present. So anyway, any other thoughts or questions?
Thank you, Dr. Schroeder, very much for being here.
Almost.
And time is clearly, you live outside of time.
Oh, happy you made it.